Welcome to the Who's Counting podcast with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Hi, I'm Cleta Mitchell. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast where we talk about everything having to do with American elections, how they're supposed to be run, how sometimes they're run not the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about it. And today, our guest is someone who has written extensively about elections in America in 2024, 23, 24, 22, 21, what's coming up, what's happened. And we're very fortunate to have Fred Lucas, who is the chief investigative correspondent and director of, I think you're the director of investigative reporting for the Daily Signal. And if you don't subscribe to the Daily Signal, you really should. We'll have Fred tell you how you can do that. It's free. I read it every day because it has wonderful information. And one of its stars is with us today. So welcome, Fred Lucas.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Fred, tell everybody a little bit about your background before we get into the meat of talking about all the wonderful things, informative things that you've written about elections in America today. Tell everybody a little bit about who Fred is.
Well, I've been working for the Daily Signal since 2016. Before that, I've worked for The Blaze and some other publications. Just last year, I wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Suppression, and it gets into details about basically that the buzzword that the left uses every time they want to block an election integrity measure is that this is voter suppression. Voter ID is voter suppression. And it just dissects that argument that basically there hasn't been a plaintiff that has said, I'm an eligible voter who was prevented from voting. However, on the flip side, there's been multiple cases of voter fraud, multiple cases of instances where you can objectively look at elections that were overturned, cases where people went to jail for voter fraud and so forth. And really dissects that what so much of the media says are myths are actually true, while their propaganda is a myth.
Well, how did you get started writing? Were you always intent upon being a writer?
Pretty much, yeah. I think so. I mean, maybe going back to my high school newspaper.
Well, that's a good place to start. And then where are you from, Fred?
From Kentucky.
Really? Okay. Yes. And then I think I read in your bio that you covered the state house in Kentucky and also Connecticut. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Right. For the Frankfort State Journal and then later for the Danbury, Connecticut News Times.
Well, now that's very interesting. Those had to be two completely different worlds.
Very different states, but both had scandalous governors. So that kind of commonality with them.
Well, that's interesting. Then we should have a whole conversation about that sometime. So you've written for a lot of different publications, and you've been with the Daily Signal since 2016. So let's talk about the Daily Signal. Then I want to come back and really do a deep dive about the book, because I think this book is a very important book. We'll put a link to where people can go to buy it. When we release the podcast, so you can give us the link so people can easily see after they hear you and see you talk about your book, where they can go access and get a copy themselves, because it's an important book, I think, for people to have and to read. But so how did you get started with working on covering election issues? Because you've really been doing this for the Daily Signal for a number of years. How did you get started doing that?
This election integrity, I had sort of covered this, I think, throughout my career on and off. But I think this has been a priority for Heritage, election integrity. Of course, Heritage has the election fraud database, as you know. And it's something I got into a little bit more as I worked here, looking into various cases and looking into, you know, specific instances where elections were overturned. Something I do want to go through, and that is that something that the left so often says and something that the media so often says is that if voter fraud happens, it's never in an organized fashion, or if it happens, it can never flip an election. that's one of the things that the that you can see in the Heritage Election Fraud Database, but you can also that I also get into chapter and verse in the book that yes, it does flip elections, often at the local level, but as many people know, as many Democrats were rejoiced, it flipped an election in 2018 after a North Carolina ballot harvesting scandal where a Republican had cheated in that case. So there were also many, many cases in which there was a cabal at work at the local level, usually, that worked in these voter fraud schemes, often in Chicago, East Chicago, New York, and so forth. Miami, about two decades ago, there was a major voter fraud in a mayor's race there. But there are many, many cases in which you can look and see where voter fraud flipped elections, and it was done in a very organized fashion.
Well, Fred, I have to tell you an interesting thing. And before I go on, let me just say for those of our audience who don't know, the Daily Signal is published by the Heritage Foundation. Yeah. And it was started about, 10 years ago. And it has a big daily circulation. And as I say, it's a free publication, and it gives a really interesting, it gives you informative information about and news that you're not going to get from if you read the New York Times or you read the Washington Post, you're not going to get the real information. And so I urge people to, it's a daily email newsletter, and it's really chock full of really great information. But one of the things that I learned in just before the general election of 2008, that I was invited to attend a meeting at the Justice Department. And the reason I was invited, remember, President Bush, George W. Bush was just the outgoing president. So at the time, his attorney general still controlled the Justice Department. And I was invited to a meeting because they were looking for, they were just searching all over Washington for a conservative to attend a meeting that was being held with all of these leftist groups and the Attorney General of the United States before the election to talk about election issues. And one of the things, so I was one of two conservatives in a room full of about 50 left-wing organizational representatives who were set clearly, I began to realize then, this 2008, I really began to realize then how much of a network they had and how they had access to these very high-level people, including the Attorney General of the United States, in a Republican administration. And what they were doing, one of the things that they were complaining about was that the Justice Department, under the Attorney General, the Bush Attorney General, had changed its protocols for investigating instances of election fraud. And would you like to know what the change, what the policy had been? The policy had been that you could never use a single instance of an election crime to look for a pattern of whether or not this was part of a bigger conspiracy or effort. You just had to, literally the FBI and the U.S. attorneys were only allowed to treat any instance of an election crime as a freestanding instance. And what the Department of Justice had just done was change that procedure to say, well, yes, if you see evidence of an election crime, look to see if there's anything bigger behind it. And all of a sudden I realized, and these left-wing groups are complaining about that. And then I thought, well, isn't that interesting? They say there's no evidence of conspiracies and big plans commit voter fraud. Well, if you have a protocol that says you're not allowed, that the investigators and law enforcement can't look for it, no wonder they don't find it.
I'm glad you brought up this massive number, this network of left-wing election groups, because that's what I often call that Tammany Hall 2.0.
and it's
basically that this is a group that they resist any election integrity reform at all costs. They resist voter ID. They resist cleaning the voter rolls, which is part of federal law under the NVRA of 1993. And this is and they work in tandem with the Democratic Party, and they and now the administrative state, particularly with this executive order 14019.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about that here in a minute.
Right. But yeah, I mean, and this is something that now that these groups have essentially been given some level of federal power. I mean, they've almost been deputized as federal agents under this executive order that Biden has pushed through.
Well, it is. They have a vast network. And was there anything in your book, when you were doing the research for your book, was there anything that surprised you, things that you really hadn't realized before you started doing the research for your book?
Well, one of the things on that same note, I mean, one of the things that kind of led me to want to do this book, even as I've been doing a lot of these stories to start with. But as I got into the research, it did occur to me that I use that term Tammany Hill 2.0, but that could maybe apply to the Pendergast machine or any of these old school Democratic machines, which is that Democrats and the left are doing the same things they were doing about 100 years ago. And it's just this is just
explain
a continual
that. Explain,
line.
Well, explain what they were doing.
Right. When I use the term Tammany Hall 2.0, that's sort of a poke back at when the left uses Jim Crow 2.0. But what Jim Crow and Tammany Hall, Jim Crow in the South, Tammany Hall in the New York in the North, and those various industrial Democratic machines, what they have in common is that they were both geared towards changing the election infrastructure and changing election laws to help get Democrats elected. Mm. And this often involved paying off constituencies. This often involved having a voter citizenship meals sometimes to move people who are new immigrants into citizenship and have them sign up to vote. Oftentimes using social services to get people out there to vote. And oftentimes emptying prisons to get people to vote.
And so
you see, I mean, perhaps it's a little bit more subtle now, but
not a lot. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking this is a pretty great analogy, Fred.
Yeah. And I think one interesting thing, and I have a lot of problems with the progressives of the early 20th century. But on the positive side for those progressives, they push back against a lot of these old school political machines. Today, the self-styled progressives are completely in alignment with what amounts to the old school political machines, the modern day Tammany Hall types. And I throw in people, organizations like the Brennan Center, which... which opposes all these moves. I put in there Stacey Abrams' group, Fair Fight Action, and particularly groups like Demos. Demos is a left-wing group that essentially wrote the Biden executive order that allows for an administrative state takeover of elections.
Well, I think that what you're describing with Tammany Hall 2.0 is a really good description, and I had never thought about it like that, but it absolutely is the same thing. I mean, what I've talked about is that in the past is that the progressives of the early 20th century wanted to promote the secret ballot, which was not promoted. It came into being in the late 19th century, early 20th century, where the government would run the elections to try to get them out of the clutches of the partisan machines at Tammany Hall and the other places. Mm-hmm. And you know, all those laws that were written to protect the voter from political manipulation and influence, you know, you couldn't campaign for so many feet of the polls and all that. And it's as though they have the last decade or so, maybe it started sooner. You probably know it better from your research, but it just seems to me that certainly it's accelerated the last decade or so to really remove all those protections that the progressions of the 20th century put in place 100 years ago and are now just flying out the window because they want to go back to the machine politics.
Yeah, and that brings up a very good point because it's in the book, the Myth of Voter Suppression, that I do get it. I have a chapter on the history of this, on history of actual voter fraud and voter suppression. But it gets into that voter registration. One of those reforms was voter registration, because that used to be basically a foreign concept. And then the secret ballot. That was also called, you probably know, the Australian ballot at one point. When reformers wanted to bring those things in, we had massive pushback from these old school political machines like Tammany Hall. Said they were not going to allow that type of thing to happen. One of the big things that they pushed back on was that they said that this will keep, and this is very similar to what you hear today. It's a little bit more race-based today, but in those days, they said this could keep the working man from voting. This will only allow the elite to vote. And they illiteracy rates were higher in the late 19th century, and they... machines tried to use that argument. They said you're disenfranchising the poor people who can't read. This is favorable to the educated people. On some level, that's true, but we did not see a massive disenfranchisement. Now, in New York, which was one of the states that adopted voter registration early, there was after voter registration, there was a drop off of about 15-20%. That's in part because you got rid of a lot of fake names and double voting. That was a case in which a lower turnout, using quotations, was a good thing. But that's very much in what you were saying. I mean, this is the reformers of the late 19th century were pushing what we consider today election integrity reforms, and today the self-styled progressives are totally in alignment with the modern day Tammany Hall types.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, people really, I think, will enjoy reading about that in your book. But you've made reference a couple of times to, I think it's a natural progression. There are a few of your columns. There are lots of articles that people can find on the Daily Signal website. But I'm going to want to talk about a couple of them, and we'll have links to those so people can get directly to your writings and the Daily Signal. But you've written a couple of great articles about this Executive Order 14019, which Biden issued on March the 7th, 2021, so right after he took office. Tell everybody who pushed that, where did it come from, and what it is.
Well, during the transition period, after around December 2020, Demos put out this research paper, basically a directive of what the Biden-Harris administration needs to do, what they can do executively without Congress to really push voting. And as we know, that the Biden administration tried to get H.R. 1 and these monstrous election bills through an all-Democratic Congress, and they failed. But they did have these... he does have the administrative state at his command, and he put out an executive order in March of 2021 in which directs a whole of government approach to increasing voter registration and voter participation.
Right. It's that, they say, oh, it's just registering people to vote, but it's right. That is
participation is key here.
And education.
Yeah, and education. And so, education, participation. So this is basically a get out the vote effort using taxpayer dollars. I think folks at the Foundation for Government Accountability have called it Biden bucks, kind of a continuation of Zucker bucks. But in this case, with education, participation, they're basically actively trying to get people to vote. Technically, it's not partisan, but in this executive order, they say that federal agencies will work with nonpartisan NGOs, just nonprofit organizations. They don't name what these are.
But we know who they are.
We do know now, after more than a year of trying to get these. Watchdog groups, members of Congress have tried to figure out who are these organizations that the taxpayers are paying these agencies to work with in terms of basically getting out the vote and getting Biden's executive order implemented. And recently, I did a story in which I was able to find out from the Indian Health Service is using Demos, who wrote the order, and the ACLU, among as well as a couple of Native American advocacy groups, to implement this executive order. And that was a significant breakthrough because the administration has been keeping a lid on this for so long. And I think that gives us the IHS is a fairly small agency, but it's gives us a window into what the how the rest of this all of government executive order is being implemented. And also the IHS is, I think it's, as you've said, it's something that the left often uses. So,
well, I will tell you that in 2004, I was doing work for the National Republican Senatorial Committee and in Oklahoma in the general election. And if you'll remember, President Bush was on the ballot for re-election. And there were a number of states where there were U.S. Senate races that were competitive, but where the presidential election was not competitive. So I had put together a project for the NRSC to target and get volunteers to go in to those Senate states in the last 2 or 3 weeks before the election, and to try to make sure that we paid attention to what was going on with those Senate races, because they weren't going to get any help from the RNC because all that was going to go to the battleground presidential states. And so I was in Oklahoma City and I started getting calls from Muskogee, Oklahoma, which is the northeast part of the state. And the Indian Health Service, which you just talked about, had posted signs and was handing out flyers. This is a federally funded clinic saying, if you do not vote for the Democrat for U.S. Senate, this health clinic could close. So be sure you register and vote in order to. And so at the time, interestingly enough, Hans von Spakovsky, who's now at Heritage, who was a good friend of mine way back then, and was at the Justice Department. And I called him and said, Hans, you're not going to believe what's going on. And of course, then we had a rule of law Justice Department. Hans got in touch with the right people. We got the flyers and they talked to this U.S. Attorney's Office in Muskogee, and they got those flyers stopped and they got the signs taken down, and they issued something, a public statement saying, this is, you know, this is not true. And, you know, but today, if that happens today, you think the Biden Justice Department is going to say, no, they're going to just, we're basically now funding the program where they're telling the poorest people, the most vulnerable people, the people who go to the Indian Health Service, all of those social service agencies, that's basically what they're telling them. You've got to vote for Democrats or, you know, we could lose all this. You could, wouldn't have a place to go get your, whatever your service is. So it's pretty scary.
Yeah. I hate to keep circling back to this point, but I mean, it goes back to those old school political machines would often tie social services to getting out the vote. And whether it's Tammany Hall or the Daily Machine out of Chicago, you know, dragging people to the polls, saying your social services depend on this. And
your job
depends on this, right? What we saw, one of the first successful FOIA requests we got back here at the Daily Signal was from HUD, in which we found out that this order was being used basically at public housing locations where HUD was like signing people up for voting. Now, it would be illegal to flat out say this, and I'm sure most people would be smart enough not to, but I mean, we don't know what every conversation that took place is, but I mean, it's reasonable that someone could infer that I better sign up to vote and vote for such and such party if I want to keep my house or keep my benefits or something along those lines. I mean, there could be an intimidation factor here.
Right. Well, You know, that's exactly right. And as we have moved further and further away from in-person supervised voting, all this voting away from any supervision makes it all the more likely people can be harassed, manipulated, threatened, and there's nothing nobody knows, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And I think this Biden executive order just contributes to that. Fortunately, the House put some language into the general government appropriations bill last week in the subcommittee. We'll see if it stays in, that prohibits funding for implementation of the executive order, with the exception of two or three programs that have previously been authorized by Congress. But I think the Biden executive order is unconstitutional, but trying to figure out how to challenge that is
right. I mean, I guess standing might be an issue and so forth with that. But
I'm hoping maybe some states might decide to take it on before too long. But
I think West Virginia has, so.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Right. But, you know, talk a little bit about some of the other primary. One of the things that you have written about are the efforts by these leftist advocacy groups to get people who are in prison or non-citizens and those kinds of pools of people involved in getting registered and voting. Talk to us about that.
Well, yeah, we did have a recent story in the Daily Signal that looked into this. And at the state level, we're seeing a lot of this. There's been effort in Oregon, California, and a few other states, blue states, of course, where they've tried to get prisoners to vote. In other cases, New York, it failed in the courts in New York City, but here in Washington, D.C., they've tried to get foreign nationals to vote in local elections. We've seen this in neighboring Maryland. Several jurisdictions allow foreign nationals to, non-citizens, I should say, to vote in local elections. You legally can't in a federal election or a state election, but, I mean, you're asking the local jurisdiction to keep two separate lists. And we could talk in depth about that, but
they can't keep one list clean and straight and accurate. I don't know how they're supposed to keep multiple lists, but don't you think these groups are counting on that?
Yeah. I think so. And I think part of this, particularly with when you're talking about non-citizens, when you're talking about prisoners, these are groups that Democrats feel like that would be favorable towards them. And I think it's very much a case that instead of how democracy is supposed to work, in which voters pick their politicians, you have like basically Democratic politicians want to pick their voters. And that's what we're seeing here.
Well, I will tell you that one of the greatest threats I think that we face as a country is if you have one party that has so changed the voting system in state after state after state, to make it virtually impossible to have a competitive election, I don't think that's healthy for our country. And I've just been watching what's been going on in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico. Just this year, the New Mexico legislature last year killed some really bad bills that would have eliminated a lot of election integrity in their statutes. They came back this year and they're just ramming those through. Minnesota's the same thing. Michigan, they're rewriting the election laws to make it where I don't think that a Republican candidate, statewide office or Republican presidential candidate will have the opportunity. There's no chance of having the opportunity for a competitive election in those states for years to come.
Yeah, that's I mean, we've seen this, and it was happening in California for more than a decade, and we've kind of seen the result there, where a guy like Gavin Newsom can get reelected and reelected. But yeah, I mean, I think it's happening in even moderately blue states or purple states once they get a legislature in there. I think they might respond, well, look at what Georgia and Florida and Arizona, they passed their laws. But I think what's very important about the 2021 election laws that were passed in Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Texas, really about 25 states passed some type of election reform laws that included some enhanced voter ID, cleaning voter rolls, restrictions on ballot harvesting. And I point this out in the book several times that importantly, Democrats called that voter suppression. But most of those laws largely reflected what was in the Carter Baker Commission report from like 2005. And there was at one point very broad bipartisan consensus on voter ID, bipartisan consensus on that the ballot shouldn't be handled by too many other people than the actual voter, which that undercuts ballot harvesting, and that you should make some reasonable effort to abide by the 1993 federal law and have clean voter rolls. Now, those things, those very common sense measures are completely polarized and partisan.
Well, but not only among the leadership of the Democratic Party. If you look at the polling data,
Across the board, citizens
support voter ID, even if you're Democrats, even if you're independents, and they support all these things. It's just this small group of the elites that actually control things. They don't want it.
But they do control things. It is the activists.
Elected officials, academia, the media.
It's a machine. It's a modern day machine.
That's a good point. It's the modern day machine.
Yeah, it's Tammany Hall 2.0. But you're very correct. I mean, almost every poll across the board, particularly with voter ID, it's about 80% that we're looking at. And when you dig down into demographics, the majority of every, it's at least 60% among African Americans, 70% in some polls, usually 60-70% among Democrats. So it support voter ID because it just sounds common sense to your regular person. And unless maybe a Democrat is really tuned in to Team Blue, who thinks I have to be against that, they're going to be for it. So.
Right. Well, there's so many things that the left has done to our election system, trying to still do, you know, having so much voting taking place in a way that having a voter ID, you know, how do you verify the identity? I've been saying that signature verification on absentee ballots is an oxymoron because I've just seen what I've seen in state after state is there really isn't real verification of the identity of people who vote by mail. And I guess that's one of the reasons that this machine wants to have it that way so that nobody can verify the identity of who people are who are voting by mail.
Yeah. And even flip that, I think you could say people's signatures change. And I think someone is probably a voter is more likely to be disqualified over their signature than to be disqualified over their ID. I mean, far more likely to. And I think if somebody out there really, really cares about total enfranchisement, they should prefer voter ID to signature. But I think the stated efforts of the left, I mean, that's not really the stated effort. They don't want anything that could block potential fraud in some cases.
No, they really don't want any. I'll just give you the continuum of what they've done to the laws. Take Nevada, for instance. The voter rolls are a mess in Nevada, and that's been documented several times. Public Interest Legal Foundation did a video a couple of years ago about that. And then the legislature passed a bill in 2021 saying that now the state must send out the county and the state, all the counties have to send out ballots, not applications, but ballots to everybody on the voter rolls. So you've got live ballots just floating around, going to people. They're duplicates. People are who are on the rolls who are dead, who've moved, So you've got all these live ballots floating around. And then there have been some studies by a journalist out there at the Las Vegas, I think it's the Journal Review.
Las Vegas Review Journal,
Where every year this one journalist has people sign their ballots in a way that's clearly doesn't look like their signature that's on record and says it's sent in and have never had a single rejection. And in fact, I think that the rejection rate is virtually zero. They're machine read. And so how in the world would you be able to know that the vote is secure there? You just cannot know that. And yet efforts to try to remedy that so people can have confidence in it are, as you say, treated as voter suppression. It's not voter suppression to try to have a clean election. So I just really appreciate all the work that you do, Fred, and tell people how they can subscribe to the Daily Signal.
It's just jump on dailysignal.com and you can sign up for our Morning Bell newsletter and email newsletter. And you can also sign up for our Capitol Bell newsletter, which comes in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, I do get it crop twice a day now that you mentioned it. That's true. That's great. And tell us how we can, where can we go to buy your book?
You can buy that anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. You can also go to the posthillpress.com website. It's available there as well.
Well, we'll put a link to that up with this interview because I really want to encourage people to read it and to buy it and share it. And really want to encourage you and thank you for all the work that you do, writing about, explaining a lot of this. People, I love your historic analogy. It makes perfect sense to me. I never thought about it quite like that, but it really connects a lot of dots for me and makes a lot of things kind of fall in place when I think about it. But really appreciate all that you do, Fred, and look forward to continuing to follow all your writings. And hope you'll come back and join us again if you write another book or write some more things. We're always interested in hearing what you have to say.
All right. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much, Fred. And that's our episode for this week. Thanks, everybody. We hope that you have enjoyed this podcast. Share it with your friends. Subscribe to whoscounting.us. Subscribe to the website. Subscribe to the podcast. Share it with your friends. As I said, visit our website. Learn about how you can be part of the effort to reclaim America's elections. And with that, we say goodbye and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much. Thank you for joining Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Please help us fight big tech censorship. Like and subscribe to this podcast and be sure to share it with your friends. You can become part of this election integrity movement by signing up to join the Election Integrity Network. Go to whoscounting.us. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Election Integrity Network.